Even at first glance, it was apparent that this was not to be a typical political forum. Instead of rows of chairs facing the stage, which held microphones, chairs, and candidates, the hall itself was an array of large round tables, which attendees were encouraged to fill completely, the better to talk among themselves as the event progressed. Then it was Evan Wigg, executive director of the Farmers Guild, who established the tone for the gathering.
It's wonderful to see you guys all here today. It's a lot of my favorite human beings all in one room. So thank you so much for taking an entire evening out to be a part of this. I guess I want to start out just giving some context about what it takes to be an effective part of your local community and working and partnering with your local government and the changes that you wish to see in your community. So who here is excited about the new CVS coming into our town? All right, so the reason I bring this up is because, as we all can see, everyone probably saw it driving in here. There's a huge hole in the grounds. CVS is coming in, and it's now going to be a cornerstone of our community right in the heart of Sebastopol. And, you know, there's a lot of things we can do about it now. You know, we can sneak in the middle of the night and chain ourselves to the bulldozers. I don't know. That's a good idea. What do you think? All right. So that's one approach. And tonight, we're not going to be talking about that approach. Tonight, we're not even going to be talking about the issues per se. We're not going to be arguing whether or not it's a good thing to have CVS or a bad thing to have CVS, whether we should ban GMOs or if we should encourage the proliferation of GMOs. We're not actually going to be talking about the issues at all. What we want to talk about is, what are the CVSs of 5 years from now? And what are you doing as engaged citizens to create the environment where what you see is either the things that you don't want to see in this community are nipped in the bud, or the things you want to see flourish, that we're actually laying the groundwork to see those things flourish. Sonoma County has an incredible history of community activism, of groups of people getting together and making incredible change that has preserved Sonoma County to be what it is today, which is a place that we all, most of us, actively choose to live here because it's beautiful and it's dynamic, bountiful, and it's, personally, I was drawn here for a reason, and I want to stick around. So the question we're going to be asking tonight is, what are the strategies that you take to affect change in the long term? So we're going to be asking you about going to city council meetings. We're going to be asking about the general plan. We're going to be asking about zoning regulations. We're going to be asking about what do we do now and how do we do it now so that we as community citizens, especially, we got a lot of young people in here. I've heard a number of times from people commenting on this. How the hell did you get young people to a political event? And, most of you, maybe not most of you, but a lot of you I know may not be so savvy with the political system. Maybe your interaction with government has been protesting. Maybe your experience has been just, chaining yourself to that bulldozer or, marching on Washington. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with protesting. There's nothing wrong with marching on Washington. But again, tonight we're going to be talking about the long term. We have a lot of farmers in here. We have a lot of permaculturalists in here. We have a lot of people who are thinking long term. So I want you to do that with your civic engagement as well. How do we, even if it's boring, even if it's not as fun as chaining yourself to a bulldozer, there's policies. There are things like the general plan, which is our constitution as a county. Those are the decisions that are made so that we have a blueprint for how we want to see this county thrive and grow and evolve. And we have a lot of people who, judging by the average age of the people in this room, are going to be around for a very long time and as part of this community. So I'm thrilled to have you here. I really encourage you to think about process, to think about strategy, to think about solution. And you'll hear more about this from your table captains and from our facilitator this evening. But again, thinking about what do you do to be effective as members of this community and feel empowered. And hopefully our goal is that we have a county representative on the Board of Supervisors who is going to work to empower you to be effective. Again, not just vote for you. We're actually going to specifically ask you not to ask for their votes tonight. We're going to ask you to simply tell them, what will you be doing to make them effective members of this community. So thank you very much for joining us, the candidates. Thank you guys so much for being a part of this, and I'm thrilled for what comes out of this evening. Thank you so much.
Next, moderator Richard Berg explained how the event would be structured and offered instructions to the crowd.
Good evening. I'm Richard, and I'm the facilitator for this evening. I want to call your attention to some of the maps for this evening that have been scattered around. The program on the table has the goals of this event on the inside, some guidelines that suggest exactly what Evan just said, which is we're looking for potentials, not problems. We're looking for the how, not the what. So check out those programs. There's one for each of you. Also on the table are the more explicit instructions for what we're going to be doing together. So I just wanted you to know what was on the table. The goal this evening is to learn about strategies for engaging from your own experience and to generate from that experience questions for our candidates to respond to how they would answer the question about connecting, about building a relationship, about affecting change, about hearing having your voice make a difference when you're interested in a particular domain of policy. On the walls, you'll see a word cloud called your interests. This came from questions we asked to those who reserved a seat this evening, and those are the words that appeared across all four questions, which are at the bottom of those charts. So you look at that, you get a snapshot of the things that are on people's mind. It's a little confusing because they were asked about their vision for the future as well as the challenges for today. But that is a picture of what people are talking about with regard to Sonoma County. Now, the tree, there are four or five of those on the wall. Those are the issues, the challenges that people identified when we asked them what they thought the greatest challenge to Sonoma County was. When someone at your table wants to talk about an issue, you can point to the chart and say, we know that, but how can we do something about it? What role could I take? And that's out of that conversation, we hope there'll be questions which enable me to have a conversation with the candidates that generates the kinds of open doors and relationships that allow you to be effective and more involved. So that's the map of this evening. Also, the calendar, the agenda is on the wall. And you'll see that the structure references the cycle of growing things. Preparing the ground, that's what we're doing right now. I'm orienting you to what we're going to do. Then we're going to plant seeds. And those are the stories you tell one another about your experience trying to connect in the county with things that matter to you successfully, or perhaps finding obstacles no matter how you tried. Out of that, we're going to generate questions. So after a break at 7:15, we're going to regather in these tables, and the questions you generated, I will bring to the candidates, and we will have a discussion about it. If things work well, it will feel to them and to me and to you like a discussion, not a bunch of talking heads. Specifically, we want to have a conversation where they're able to bring their experience and the way they want to carry the role, should they be elected, of connecting with the community that they represent. The candidates are free to wander around and eavesdrop, to think about what they're hearing as people's experience, successes and failures or difficulties, but not to sit down and participate and not to participate as they're listening. Their experience listening to you will be a much bigger smorgasbord than the two questions we get from every table, which are the seeds for conversation with them.
Most of the next hour was devoted to those table-by-table conversations. Then, following an intermission, Berg rejoined the candidates on stage with a handful of cards bearing the questions the table groups had generated earlier.
So, we're going to begin a conversation generated by your questions. But first, I really wanted to ask our guests, Tim, Noreen, and Linda, if they could each share with us their recollection of their first motive to be involved in service or political activity. Maybe it happened in kindergarten when you sold Christmas cards and gave the money to cerebral palsy, or maybe it happened last week when you did something else. So, Tim, you want to start?
Okay, how's that? Okay, so I've been interested in politics for a long time. When I was 10 years old, I used to have a subscription to U.S. News and World Report. But then the moment that really, for me, was powerful when I was serving in the Army in Central America, in Honduras, and it was there was a volunteer mission that you could volunteer to go to resupply an orphanage. And so we hiked down the mountain that we were on the top of and brought food and supplies. And that was such a powerful moment for me. I'd never seen children happier at Christmas. And that showed me the power of what individuals could do to positively affect lives. And so since
Thank
then.
You. Yeah. So a kind of Honduran Santa Claus is what you made it sound like.
Very much
Noreen.
So for a minute there, I thought you were going to ask, what was your first experience in politics? And I flash back to the moment when I was in high school, and my mother and I decided to go to a city council meeting. And I was too afraid to open the door. That's how intimidated I was. And we actually left without going inside. But I've kind of gotten over that now. So I never actually intended to be in politics, although my degree is in government, which is the equivalent of political science, and I've studied power and influence and that kind of dynamic my entire career in college. But I was a young mother of three children living in what I thought was a fabulous neighborhood in Santa Rosa, and the city of Santa Rosa decided it was going to build the equivalent of a freeway at the end of my street, which is now Fountain Grove Parkway. And at the time, I was very upset about what I was hearing, and so I decided, well, I can either sit around and complain, or I can go down to City Hall and I can get involved. And at the time, the city council was basically evicting a planning commissioner who had blown the whistle on a City Hall subsidy for a multi-million dollar tax subsidy for the development of what's called the Marketplace. It's the big box retail now on Santa Rosa Avenue. So they threw him off and they put me on. And the more I listened and asked questions, the more alarmed I became about how decisions actually got made at City Hall. And this discussion tonight was really revealing because I became more alarmed at the fact that I felt the public's interest was not being well served. And so I asked lots of questions, and eventually people started asking me to run for city council. I went home one night and related this to my family, and my little children looked at me and said, well, what'd you say, Mom? And I said, no, kind of tied up with you kids and our work and all that. And they said, well, why not? And so I kind of had to ask myself that question. And at every step of the way, I've asked myself that question.
Mm-hmm.
So here
you.
I am.
Sounds more like an incremental process than the moment you had at the door of City Hall when you were a young girl, which might have kept you out of politics if you'd been awake. Linda?
I would say that my public service actually started 9 years ago when I started an organic farm. And that was largely the result of what I studied in college. I was very fortunate to attend Stanford University. I graduated with a master's degree in land use policy and an undergraduate degree in coastal land use. But in some ways, what I majored in was climate change. I was a head program TA, and I was teaching Stanford freshmen about climate change and about El Nino and about the world food economy and global poverty and the Green Revolution, all of these topics where I felt like we were in this ivory tower learning everything that was wrong with the world. And there was so much that was wrong with the world. And we were trying to balance that there is so much that's wrong with the world with what can you do about it incrementally? You know, can you weatherize your home? Can you use less water? Can you do these small things that when you add them up into collective action really make a huge, tremendous difference? And so when my husband and I graduated, we had the opportunity to plant a basically a sort of large market garden. And we felt like that was something that we could do that was very tangible, that would attack some of those issues that we had spent 6 years learning about. And so we've been doing that for the past 9 years, and that brought us to advocacy, because when you start a small farm, suddenly, you know, you're a small business owner and regulation comes in that might impact your life, and you start to speak up and speak out about it. So
it sounds like some of it came from necessity as your life evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Based
Absolutely.
On what you did at Stanford. So I've got a stack of questions, which I've tried to sort in some sense, and we'll just begin. And one of the concerns, and it clearly was part of our design of the evening, is to find ways to increase the possibility of engagement. Engagement with those who are elected, and for you, should you be elected, engagement with those people you represent. So I'll read this question directly and we'll see where it takes us. What will you do to re-empower citizens, especially the young and marginalized, when their attempts at influencing county decisions fail, leaving them dejected and even disillusioned? So this is about people who've actually had some experience trying to do something, maybe as simple as getting a permit or something else, and they find the process blocks their not just blocks the action, but it dampens their enthusiasm and willingness to show up. So what's that like when you hear about that and things you think about to change that? Linda, okay. Any start?
Great. Well, to me, it comes down to accessibility. I have often felt like it, you know, you can sort of send emails out or you make phone calls and they sort of disappear into the ether, and no one ever gets back to you. So I think it's tremendously important to be accessible as a leader. And I think that one way of doing that is just straight up face-to-face. You know, some people call it retail politics. I would love to, you know, have office hours in all of the different, you know, little tiny towns and hamlets that we have throughout the 5th District. Think about driving from Annapolis to Santa Rosa to visit your supervisor, or Timber Cove. I mean, we have a huge district, and so I think it's really important that we have leaders who are willing to go out in the community and sort of actively solicit input rather than kind of, you know, again, sitting in the ivory tower. I also think I can talk a lot, so I can also – do you have sort of a time sense or how – I don't know.
That's why I'm here.
Okay, great. another thing I'd love to talk about is technology and using technology to engage with the community. I think a lot of people have cell phones, and we could make better use of them.
That's true, but Tim or Noreen, what do you think about that, the difference between using Skype or some come-to-meeting or Google Hangup as a way of connecting, which sounds like it would expand opportunities, or face-to-face? I mean, the 5th District is, in truth, enormous, and it's further north than Annapolis and further south than Santa Rosa. So,
well, I think that there's an element of that for, you know, social media and ways to reach out. Yet, in my experience, there's a lot of people said, hey, you know, there's a lot of people don't use social media. And so I really think there's no replacement for just being engaged in the community and doing things like this, showing up to meetings, helping facilitate town hall meetings, and just really being the face of the government for the local, you know, 27 communities that are here in the West County. I think that's what I've heard that people really want, is somebody who's going to be there, who's going to be honest, who's going to show up, and who will listen and be the voice of the 5th District.
So there's no substitute for face-to-face interaction, none. I mean, we people kind of had this dream that electronics would take place of that, right? You can work virtually or you can have a virtual conversation by Skype or whatever. There simply is no substitute for that personal interaction. But speaking as one who has represented a number of different people in rural districts, my Senate district was 1.2 million people actually, and included all the 5th plus 7 other counties. One of the things that I developed doing was electronic town hall meetings, and because you can't always do personal town hall meetings. And what that did was I would organize it around a theme for example, I did one on state parks. I did one on my GMO legislation. And it allowed people to call in. They would ask their questions, and I would actually give them a response right there on TV, and they could see, and it was a little bit interactive. So when you can't touch every individual, there are other ways of doing that. Your question really got to, though, I think, a frustration that citizens often have, and one of the things I heard going around from table to table was this kind of, well, two different levels of frustration. One is that government is very complicated. There's a lot of rules. There's a lot of different documents you have to deal with. There's a zoning code. There's a health and safety code. There's a general plan. There's various things that you have to know your way around. In addition to which, there's various levels of government. And so there's some frustration because there's a big bureaucracy. And if you come into contact with that bureaucracy, it can be extremely frustrating. And you can walk away feeling like, I tried, I did my best, but boy, that is just a disaster. I'm never going back there. So one of the jobs, I think, of the representative is to help citizens that find themselves in that quagmire, people who are trying to find their way, navigate their way through the government. And that's part of the job of the representative, is to help them find their way.
But the challenge, of course, is you couldn't help a million people find their way. So if we have...
Unfortunately, not a million people try to find their way all at the same time.
Right. Or you'd need a really big billboard.
Right.
But the issue of... another question is, what would you recommend to someone who feels marginalized, especially in terms of being, of creating an effective citizen advisory committee? This is to the question of your listening as opposed to helping someone navigate. I don't know that the citizen advisory committee has ever been tried, but let's assume it's a stand-in for citizens coming together and connecting with you. What would you say about that kind of a proposition?
So, go ahead. Sorry. Well, I was just going to observe that we have a number of different committees that people serve on. They're not called a citizen advisory committee, although we do have ad hoc task forces from time to time. For example, there's one on law enforcement right now that's made some recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. That's one example. There's planning commissions and others.
I was very fortunate to be able to be involved in the creation of a local citizens advisory group, and that was the Forestville Planning Association. And that really grew out of a frustration. There was a development that started in Forestville. It was storage containers went, a facility went in and a sensitive habitat, and it was just a done deal before, by the time people wanted to know about it, it was a done deal. And so that frustration grew that, hey, you know, the locals should have some say in these developments. And so basically, led by a woman, Joan Reebok, created it, and we put together the Forestville Planning Association. And I would suggest is this is definitely doable, but you have, then we reached out to the supervisors, and Efren Carrillo at the time came to meetings, and we held town hall meetings. And the FPA is now has been very instrumental in creating a downtown park and really become quite an amazing organization.
So you're describing a process where someone saw a need as a result of something they literally saw in the neighborhood that stimulated people. What was the process? How long did it take? How long should it take for a small group of people to recognize an issue that they share a set of concerns about, or in this instance, the removal of sensitive habitat and perhaps an ugly wall of containers? How long did it take?
It took about, from the initial meetings, it took about a year for it to really get to gel and get the, you know, the,
and did,
501.
Did the so you became a 501c3.
Yeah.
Did that change how much influence you appeared to have?
Yeah, I mean, it did. Once the town hall meetings happened, that's when it really started, the influence started, became more powerful, when you gathered people around. And then also it was important that the Forestville Plan Association wasn't the only voice. There was other voices in the community that really came out And that brought other voices out as well that created even a larger, more powerful movement.
Any thoughts about this, Linda?
I think that it's most powerful when these kinds of things actually come from the community. I mean, there's sort of two ways to go about this, right? There's sort of the top-down approach and there's the ground-up approach. And the county government has implemented a number of sort of citizens advisory committees or task forces, which I think are effective, but they come from a top-down approach where then you have a very competitive application process. And that's, again, I think where some people can wind up disenfranchised because they don't know the right people that sort of floats their application to the top. So I actually love the idea of more ground-up citizens advisory committees who just sort of take it on themselves. And then, you know, perhaps you establish one of the people as the leader of that group to try and check in regularly with the supervisor and just kind of give, you know, updates on your progress. And it's just kind of one more way for government to reach out into the community. Because since we don't have, you know, we have the city of Santa Rosa and we have the city of Sebastopol, none of the other towns are incorporated. Almost all of them have some kind of entity, like the Forestville Planning Association, and that's a great point of contact for the supervisor. But there aren't enough of those because that one entity and that one community doesn't necessarily reflect all of the diverse viewpoints. I would love to have a couple of those in every community. So,
any thoughts about this, Noreen?
I think, well, there's 45, I think I counted 45 special districts in the fifth. Fire districts, sewer districts, park and recreation districts. But Linda explained kind of the issue with that. Not everybody knows how to get plugged in. And having citizens organizations, you know, it's not just organizations either that decide to come up from the ground up. There's already existing organizations that also have a loud voice. Sierra Club being one. There's any number of different groups and clubs around that have some area of expertise that will be able to amplify an individual voice. And being involved in those, Rotary Club, for example, Chambers of Commerce, there's so many of them, it's hard to even enumerate all of them.
So that must be a challenge for someone who's elected to sort through the messages coming to them from these various voices, and the voices have different power profiles in the community. I mean, you mentioned the Rotary Club. That's very different profile than the West County Earthworm Growers Association.
Yes, it is.
So how do you balance that out and manage the voices of many constituencies, some of which have a really different level of visibility and power in the community? Because that is the source, just to finish, of frustration. I mean, how can the average individual, without significant power or money, enter the county decision-making progress early enough to have an impact on the decision before the public hearing, when a decision has has already mostly been formed? I've been involved in Healdsburg civic activity for more than 10 years, and I'm not sure the decision has already been formed. But it's so difficult to have a generative conversation on the dais in front of an audience that is truly open and people are trying to figure out what they should vote on, which way they should vote. It's almost as difficult as having a conversation here on this stage among the four of us. But we'll continue with that. So how can the average individual connect early in the process? What does it take?
I honestly think we need to change the process. And I think the county is doing some of that already, where we actually do have sort of public outreach meetings really early on. That's some of my sort of engagements with county government has been, suddenly there's an ordinance that was released in 2014 about farm stands, and yet they never talked to any farmers about it and have never even really been to a farm stand in Sonoma County, because you read the ordinance and they clearly didn't know exactly what they were talking about. So why do we not have more of the things like, you know, we've got the winery working group events meeting that I thought was a really productive conversation. They had a big venue, Glazer Center, you know, and a really, I thought, positive conversation with people sharing their perspectives as things were happening, not after they'd already been done. But I would also love to see, I mean, why aren't we talking about notification? When you have a development going in down the street and you've got an 8x11, you know, piece of paper like taped to a telephone pole and that's the only notification that the community gets, come on. We have cell phones. We have email. We have, you know, you could do mass text messages. We need to get the word out so that people can participate in the process because they don't even know the process is happening, let alone, you know, it's all often happening behind closed doors. So we've got two problems in my mind.
How do you get information, Tim, about what's happening out there? And
well, I think, yeah, definitely there should be better communication to the public. Yet, as the way things stand, what can the person do that's frustrated this? I think just by attending events like this, talking to your neighbors, unfortunately, I mean, I think that's still one of the best ways is just to be connected with the people around you, and so that that information gets out there. And then that's kind of the only way to really counteract some of the larger, more powerful forces that you mentioned. That people have, and people do have a voice. And if enough people come out, we've seen it happen where there can be enough pushback and that can change the trajectory of development. And so I think that's the important thing is to stay connected and to talk to your neighbors.
So one of the reasons I'm excited about coming back to local government is I have always been the kind of person that enjoys the casual interactions with the people that I represent. And I can remember so many times having been in local government, being stopped in Safeway and embarrassed because I'm yelling at my kids and somebody's waiting to talk to me. Or being at the local coffee shop and somebody comes by and says, hey, what about this issue? And I think the elected official gets a whole lot out of just being in the community and talking to people. But it is a huge community. And so I think a large part of the job of supervisor is making sure to travel to all of these special districts and have meetings with them on a regular basis, talking to different organizations in the community, whether it's the Rotary Club or the Chamber or whatever, going to local community events so they can have these casual interactions. But I also want to comment on the question itself because the point of being early enough in the process is so critical. And I have seen decision after decision get made with no input. And one of the things I've heard tonight is the question of how do these decisions get made when they are precisely the opposite of what the public wants? One prime example being what we think is going to happen with the beach fees proposal at the Coastal Commission on Wednesday. How does that happen? Well, there's reasons it happens. That one is maybe a little extreme example, but it's because people don't show up, people don't talk, and we need to have that input. And you hear a lot just by, like we did tonight, circulating.
So you mentioned 45 special districts, and sometimes people think a way to be involved is to attend those meetings, and they discover they're the only person there, the fire district, the special.
Yeah.
While I understand that it's important to you as an elected to understand what those districts need because they're providing essential services, especially in rural areas, but do you think it's a valuable way, other than learning the process, for someone out in Annapolis to connect with the fire district there or something to get closer to the kinds of changes that people are interested in seeing countywide? Is there some value in working your way up when, in fact, there are things in your front yard that really you don't feel can wait?
Well, I mean, if your issue is fire, then obviously right. That's a good place to start, right? If your issue is the environment, you should probably go to the Sierra Club meetings, you know, or find a group of like-minded people with whom you share a lot in common. So again, like Noreen said, to really amplify your voice and you know, and get that out there. So I wouldn't necessarily say that there's a prescribed path to which, you know, then suddenly you're supervisor and you are like texting on a regular basis. But I, you know, I would just say join groups that share your values, that share your beliefs, that are likely to advocate for the issues that most concern you.
I also want to mention the county does have, you can go on the county website and you can sign up for emails based on whatever your interests happen to be. If you're interested in water and you want to know what the county is doing on the groundwater management study, you can sign up for regular emails. That's just one example. So if you're doing that and you find something that you're interested in, go to the public hearing. Don't be like me and be afraid to open the door. Go in. Every meeting has like a 2 or 3 minute, every person gets a 2 or 3 minute opportunity to address the board and say whatever is on their mind. And that's one way, actually, of bringing some issues up to a broader audience of people, too, that may be watching and wanting to plug in.
My personal experience was it was far more effective to speak from the audience in City Hall than to be burdened with the responsibility of being an elected official. That if one is prepared to show up and shows up regularly and makes a contribution, it becomes a much richer route to seeing change. Because the truth is that electeds operate under an enormous set of restraints, whether it's the Brown Act or how they're able to discuss and look at alternatives in a public way, it's very difficult. And how would you manage this? I haven't gotten to them. There are some questions about transparency, the processes that you participate in. What would you do to increase people's ability to connect because they see what's happening as opposed to reading about it in the PD?
I mean, one thing that strikes me as a little bit crazy is the fact that, you know, the Board of Supervisors public comment is mid-afternoon on a Tuesday, which is pretty much inaccessible for working people who work 9-to-5 jobs. And then I've seen people who take off their time from work, you know, because it's supposed to be at 1 p.m. And then, you know, then it gets pushed back a half an hour because closed session went long and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And then there's, you know, 50 people who are signed up. And so suddenly they've taken time off from work. They're there with their whole little speech prepared and they have to leave before they go away, you know, before they get the chance to speak their piece. And so that I know has been talked about and maybe has even happened over the years, but having, you know, before or after work times for public comment is a really simple one. We could also utilize technology, you know, in terms of maybe people could Skype into a supervisor's meeting. They could just, you know, sneak into the bathroom at work and, you know, I mean, we could think outside the box here. But to me, the only opportunity you have to address the full board is, you know, at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday. That's not accessible to the majority of people in Sonoma County.
Well, I think you also just, again, have to be available. You have to make it to out into the community. You have to make time for your constituents. That just is part of the job. You have, and it's weekends, it's evenings, and I think that having that personal one-on-one connection with your constituents is one of the best ways that you can be effective.
And I think it's a constant challenge too to make sure that you are accommodating people. You might have the public hearing at 1 o'clock. On one Tuesday and 5 o'clock on another, or 8 a.m. on another. So I have chaired meetings where people have had to say, you know what, we're running past 5 o'clock and my daycare babysitter leaves at 4:30, so can I be moved up in the queue so I can speak? And you have to be able to accommodate that, and it requires a little bit of flexibility on the part of the elected official, which I think is extremely important.
There are a bunch of questions about representation. How will you, as a supervisor, level the playing field for communities that are disadvantaged or lack political connections and ensure they have equal representation? And what processes would you change so the county can be more responsive and supportive of agreed-upon community and individual needs so there can actually be some change? So it's one thing for the audience to know what's on the agenda and what's being moved. But often the experience of their voice being represented is buried in the process, that they can't hear themselves coming back as things may or may not be moving through the system. Have you any experience with that and thoughts about how you might change that so that the channel of information coming to you, in fact, doesn't disappear in policy language, in
right.
Ignoring it or whatever?
Well, and how does something make its way to the agenda to begin with? That often is a mystery to people, and I have to admit sometimes it's a mystery to me too, as long as I've been in government. But issues make their way to the agenda because, and I think I'm quoting Margaret Mead here, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, the only thing that has ever changed the world is a small committed group of people. So if a small committed group of people wants to bring forward an issue and they've got a responsive supervisor, that will get on the agenda. And sometimes it's not very transparent how that happens, but it is as simple as coming to a public hearing and making yourself heard, or, you know, talking to your supervisor about this group of people wants to move something forward. The other part of this is government can be very bureaucratic and very slow. I can think of projects that I started that took 20 years before they came to fruition. You have to be persistent, and you have to not take no for an answer, and you have to never give up. And sometimes, take, for example, the smart tax. It took time after time after time on the voters' ballot. And was it the fourth time we finally got it passed? You know, you just, if you've got an idea and you're fully committed to it and you think that the public supports it, you can't say no to can't take no for an answer, and you just have to continue working it forward.
Go for it.
So I just kind of add on that as far as, you have to be persistent. And I think another thing that's really important is, as a teacher, you have to present things in a way that the average person can understand them. And you have to come to people with good information. You have to put it out there in an everyday language so that people can make a decision. Sometimes it gets so caught up in the bureaucratic language and complications that it makes it hard for people to make an average decision and to feel like they're part of the process because they don't understand what's going on. And so I think that's one thing that's really critical, is to have someone that can kind of distill things. And that's one thing I've done in my experience, is to distill things down to the basics that help us make decisions and help get people behind. If you feel like you have a good program, really break it down and explain it to where people can get behind it and move it forward.
Yeah. There are a bunch of questions about the structure of meetings, and I think your description of the public comment section being at 1 and maybe moving it to the evening, the interesting thing about that is the public comment section is reserved for comments for anything that is not on the agenda. So the real challenge is designing a meeting structure open to the public that allows people to be there for the thing they're interested in, because the public comment section can be 50 people talking about 51 different things, right? So that is interesting but challenging in its own way. It's a way in, but it isn't about specific things. So thinking about your own experience with meetings as a member of the public or sitting on a board of some kind, is there anything that you've imagined you could do to make it easier for people to be there when the thing they're interested in is being discussed? This is a tough question. We should give them some time to think about it.
Well, it's a tough challenge, because what may suit somebody at 9 a.m. won't suit somebody else at 9 a.m. You know, maybe somebody's work schedule is from midnight to 8, and they can't make an evening, or they've got kids at home after school, and they can't come after 3 p.m. There is no one-size-fits-all. And I think the answer to this is something I've said in every hearing I've ever chaired, and that is there's not one single way to communicate with the board. You have to use email, write letters, make phone calls, show up in person, show up at my office, whatever method you can use to communicate, because it's not possible to accommodate everybody's schedule. I always like meetings that begin and end on time, and where you have a time certain, okay, at, you know, 8 a.m. we're going to start this, and at 1 p.m., because we know there's so many people interested in this issue, we're setting aside all of our other business and we're going to this particular issue. And that way you know it's going to be discussed between 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. And that's about the only way you can really structure a meeting to make sure most people have the opportunity to speak on something.
I'm going to, since this is a conversation, answer a question with a question. And that's that, you know, we've got four people up on this stage who are not afraid to speak up, obviously, who are not afraid to get in front of a microphone and ask questions or make comments. I think we've got a room full of people who feel the same way, and this room full of people feels disengaged from the process. But what about the people who are afraid to even come to a meeting? You know, the number of undocumented residents that we have living in the 5th District who don't have the power to vote, who have a totally understandable fear of authority because 10 years ago we were deporting them from the streets of Sebastopol, the police department was, you know, and it was just a couple years ago that there was an automatic IHSS trigger, or no, sorry, that's in-home health service. No, wait, I got it right. There we go. You know, that when you were sort of, you know, booked into the county jail, it automatically triggered immigration. So how do we reach out to people who are not coming to meetings? Because I think that is also the role of elected officials. And I've had the experience, you know, knocking on doors in these communities or standing out in front of grocery stores where, you know, you try to have conversations and as soon as you sort of introduce yourself as a candidate, there's a fear. So I guess how do we, it's great that we can have this conversation, but I feel like this conversation is bigger than us. And how can we, I don't know if you guys have some ideas, how do we reach out to these communities that are so at risk? Because they are the most likely to be victimized by predatory landlords. They are the most likely to be, you know, working for sub-minimum wage and paid cash and not paid when the job is done. So I feel like we also have a responsibility to represent people who don't vote for us, and would love to talk a little bit about that.
It would probably, this is out of school, I think, it would probably help if there were more people with dark skin here.
Yeah.
And it is important to have someone that can speak Spanish, and that is one thing that I do bring is being able to speak Spanish so I can get out. And I've noticed that even just walking in parts of Roseland where I'm surprised a lot of people, they're much more approachable if you can speak to them in their language. And so that's really important to have people that speak a language that reaches everyone, not just their mind, but with their heart. And then get out, and it's going to take outreach, like what both Linda and Noreen are saying, is that you got to have multiple modes to for people to communicate with us, and then also for us to be out in the community with the churches or with with all the different with the schools, so that you have some way where people can get involved in making sure their voices are heard.
And I want to follow up on what Tim just referred to. I think it's really important for the supervisor to develop relationships with the organizations that are working in these communities, because it's really hard for somebody to go up and say, "Hi, I'm Noreen Evans, I'm running for supervisor," and have somebody immediately trust who has been in a vulnerable position, who may not speak the language, and who doesn't feel trusting of authority. So there are a number of organizations already doing the work, churches being a very good example, and developing relationships with those organizations where the trust is already there. Really important.
Boys and Girls Club, really active.
Another good one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned the word trust because it's come up in a couple of questions. One is, this is an interesting twist on the question of trust. How can decision makers be confident that they're receiving full and accurate information from staff when they're...
Did you know you're on your phone?
Oh,
yeah.
Your chair is on your phone.
The question is, how can you be sure you're getting accurate information from the staff?
Ah, very good question.
And then how would you look to the community to find local experts or people with information relevant to the decision before you, since you deal with such a volume of information at the supervisory level, you can't possibly read every word of a packet, is my fantasy. I don't know that for a fact. But
I actually was really committed to reading every single word of the packet when I was a journalist, you know, and also on deadlines. And so I think that's actually incredibly important is going over, you know, line by line, word by word. But I also think that we have a tremendous resource and tremendous intellectual resource in the community. You know, I was a journalist. It's not very hard to sort of, you know, Google. And I think that all of us know enough people in the community that we know, you know, who we might want to pick up the phone and call about, you know, groundwater management or seismic hazards would be an easy one. And, you know, there are a lot of people here who have tremendous experience. And so I think that you just need to make sure that you read the staff report and then you call at least three people. Someone told me that, you know, you have to have the golden Rolodex. I think it's probably the golden iPhone now. But you just got to have those contacts and not be afraid to make the call.
Right. Yeah, I would just say you have to also... getting the trust, I think you have to trust people that their expertise, and I think that is important. I believe you can't get through every bit of information. There's just so much. There are volumes and volumes of. I mean, President Obama is not reading the entire federal budget. You know, it's 10 feet tall. So you have to rely on the people around you and their expertise, and then question them. If you see something that doesn't really make sense into your own common sense, I think you have to kind of question that, and to try and get answers that make sense. And to try to make the sense of it. And I totally agree with Linda that we have tremendous resources here as part of the larger Bay Area. It's amazing being out in the public, meeting the resource we have here in our community. And they're very willing to share that. So I think that is another resource that we can all draw on.
So if I may, this is a really insightful question because as a longtime elected official, there's always a tension between the elected official and the staff. And the best staff will try to take the leadership of the elected official and try to anticipate what that elected official would like to do or like to see in a particular issue. What is really important, though, is that the elected official has to know themselves, and the voters need to know what that elected official stands for, what their values are. When a person is newly elected, and I've mentored a lot of newly elected officials, there's inevitably a question that they could come down on either side or maybe all three or four sides of a particular issue. And what I've always said to them is you know what your value is in that question. You know, what is the most important thing to you as an individual? Because the voters put their trust in you. They elected you to make that decision. You know, if it's different from what staff is recommending, think about it, understand it, but understand your core and what your core value is, and then make the decision based on that.
The question of housing that people can afford versus affordable housing, which is a state-described category of subsidized housing, which people confuse a lot when having conversations about, I can't find a place to live. But the issue of housing is not unique to Santa Rosa or Healdsburg or Sonoma County. And yet there are people in the county really prepared to talk about innovative solutions, ways of collecting residences that are not currently enabled by any legislation or ordinance in the county. How do you feel about addressing these challenges from the position of the county as an elected? I mean, how would you see alternative solutions to the crisis in housing?
So I think one thing we can do is try to make affordable housing more affordable at the permit level. At the Santa Rosa Democratic Club forum, a woman came up to me afterwards and said that she had a big house, her children had all moved away, and she wanted to create some affordable houses. She wanted to create an apartment out of one bedroom and one bathroom, and she said that the county told her it was going to be $30,000. So with the construction cost, it was going to be $70,000. So there goes your affordable housing. So I think we need to really look at the cost. And talking to the PRMD, they say those are a lot of added-on permits. If you look at the actual cost of permits, they say they're really managing a lot of other permits that get tacked on the top. So I think we really need to look at, if we're serious about affordable housing, well, let's make the permits to build affordable housing affordable.
So I'm on the board of directors of Greenbelt Alliance. And for those who don't know, Greenbelt Alliance is an alliance of nine Bay Area counties, all of the nine Bay Area counties and the cities within all of those nine Bay Area counties. And what we try to do is advocate for policies within those counties and cities that do two things. One is preserve agricultural lands outside urban areas, and two is provide city-centered growth. And personally, I've been a longtime advocate of city-centered growth policies. And what we can do with city-centered growth policies is we can build more dense, smaller housing units within urban areas where services already exist, and particularly along the smart rail corridor where a family may not have to have two cars or even one car to get around. And by its very nature, that kind of housing is much more affordable to working families than, say, a mansion in Fountain Grove, development. That kind of housing is really where people can enjoy more of urban living and spend less on transportation, more on housing and more on food, and more on quality of life.
I would second what both of you guys said. I think that in many cases, the county has actually made it cost prohibitive to do the right thing. And that we also have sort of refused to look at some of these outside of the box solutions. Like, for instance, I heard some conversations about pocket neighborhoods, eco villages, agri hoods, these, you know, tiny houses for farm workers, these kinds of things that I think we really need to look at and take very seriously, even though I think for a long time they've been kind of considered fringe concepts. We need to bring them into the mainstream. And I also, you know, one thing that I've talked a little bit about is that we actually have a regressive fee structure at the county when it comes to housing developments. So we have a development impact fee that is on a per unit basis. So if you're a developer, you're trying to develop 10 acres of land, you could build 10 McMansions on that, you know, one house per acre, pay 10 development impact fees. Or you could put in 200 units of dense, you know, urban development type housing and pay 200 development impact fees. Something as simple as changing that from a per unit impact fee to a per square foot impact fee would actually incentivize dense development and basically tax the McMansions. And that's, again, supposedly radical in government. But to me, it's like common sense, people. Common sense.
Common sense is radical in government.
Right. Amen.
Right. And that's, I think it's interesting that this audience was gathered around the issue of rural life and farming. And farmers have to be more practical and have more common sense than any other jobs in the world we live in today. I mean, you don't have to be practical to design Oculus Rift so you can walk around in an imaginary world. That's not practical, no matter how much fun it is. So here's one about a couple of questions about innovation and bringing innovation to government. And think about your answer to this. What would the process be to adopt an overarching resolution legalizing, and this is innovation for sustainability? There's another one about models, the county supporting innovation through demonstration models. I can't find that question particularly. But how to bring
innovation.
Can you repeat
the question?
Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
What is the process to bring an innovative model in?
Yeah, what would the process be to have an ordinance, an overarching resolution, an ordinance, legalizing, as if it's illegal now, innovation for sustainability? So I think it's about bringing creativity to the governmental process around lots of things, maybe not just housing, but it certainly comes up when people talk about housing.
A couple of different things that I've learned. One is it's very difficult to innovate in government. There's always somebody that says you can't do that, and there's always a reason why you really can't. Doing something that is a test case, so adopting an ordinance that might apply for a limited period of time in a limited place, studying that for 3-4 years, whatever is the appropriate amount of time, bringing it back to the Board of Supervisors and the Citizens Advisory Group, which hopefully you've formed around that, and actually studying it, having data, and making a decision based on data, which is another thing that's very unusual, fact-based decision-making. I think that's one way of doing that. Another a little bit more, a little further than that, is to adopt an ordinance for a certain period of time and have a sunset on it. So you say, okay, we're going to pass this ordinance countywide for 3-4 years, and at the end of that period of time, we're going to have collected enough data, and we're going to review it, and we're going to discuss it and debate it as a community and decide whether we'll let that end or we'll move forward and do it permanently. That's a couple of ways of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Sunsetting and time limit.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was a fantastic answer, and I could not agree more. And one example actually was I'm constantly pitching composting toilets, kind of a pet passion of mine. And so I was actually pitching it, the idea to Ruth Furch there, and saying, why doesn't the county allow composting toilets? And she's like, guess what? There was a pilot project in Occidental a couple years ago about composting toilets. It never got off the ground. No one actually participated. And I was like, you know, scratching my head. So I go and I actually read the sort of, you know, ordinance that was drafted, and it was sort of ridiculous. I think it got mired down in so many layers of bureaucracy that I, as a homeowner, would never have signed up for it. And I love composting toilets. So if I'm not going to do it, something's wrong. You know, so that's a case where we tried something. Clearly that particular ordinance didn't work. Again, still a good idea. Can we revise that? Can we make it a little bit more streamlined for the homeowner so you don't read it and think, oh my goodness, they're going to destroy my house and walk in on me when I'm going to the bathroom because the county has a permanent easement into my restroom. I mean, it was odd. It was, you know? And so, yeah. And then they didn't, the county would install the toilet, but then when they took it out, they weren't required to like put your old toilet back in. So then you're left with a gaping hole in the ground. I don't know. So, you know, can we actually look at things that aren't working and try them in a different way. But I think you totally nailed that, and I agree.
Well, and this is a perfect example of government saying no, or saying no when it's supposedly saying yes.
Exactly.
And that happens way too often, where something like that happens, where you write an ordinance that is so burdensome, nobody will ever do it. So it's really important for the public official to recognize that that's what's happening and cut their way through that mess.
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree, and I'd just like to add to that, to one thing that the public official could do is to try and create a culture of accepting a new technology, accepting, promoting types of new solutions, because this is going to become a huge issue, especially in the rural parts of our district. There's already, I met someone who's septic, with the septic systems that has failed, and they say in 2 weeks they're going to demo our house. And so that's not creating more affordable housing. It's doing the opposite. And one thing with these biodigesters, it's also something that if somebody has a septic system that has failed, it's going to become a large issue because you have to have a new field, right? You can't. And so I think we need to look at this, especially, and it's also a water quality issue because you have a lot of these failed systems that are really polluting the Russian River. And if we gave people another alternative, such as these biodigesters, they're putting out clean water, it could have a tremendous impact. And they're supposedly redoing the regs, but from what I understand, somebody just looked at the draft, and there's only one little paragraph about gray water. So when we talk about, again, are we really progressive in our thinking, or are we just really doing something that's not really going to be effective? Yeah.
So we've pretty much run out of time. There's still a few moments to try to have a conversation about one of the issues for me. There was only one question about this, is being a supervisor is both on the board of the Sonoma County Agency and the Sonoma County Water Agency, an enormously large, the water seems to keep coming out, successful organization. Do you see any conflict in those roles as they exist? It's like two jobs in one when you look at the size of the organizations.
Oh yeah, they're huge. And one thing that's going to be critical to have a supervisor that's really actively involved in the Sonoma County Water Agency, because the state is going to have, they're already under order to come up with a GSA, groundwater security agency, to monitor our groundwater. And this has to be put in place by June of 2017. That seems like a long ways away. It's only a little over a year from now. And if we do not come up with a quality plan for monitoring our own groundwater, then the state will be able to come in, the State Water Resource Control Board will be able to come in and take over control, because we have critical basins here in Sonoma County. So it is a huge job, and the way it's set up, we need our supervisors have to be very intimately involved in creating the new GSAs.
So I think historically some of the public concern about a conflict of interest is that the Sonoma County Water Agency has a role as a retailer of water. And so that would imply an interest in continued growth and development in the county. And so there's been some public concern, in the past at least, that that created a conflict of interest for supervisors being both approving development or not approving development and sitting as members of the board of the water agency. I think it was Virginia Strom Martin carried legislation when she was in the assembly to change that, and it didn't go anywhere. But, you know, that is kind of an issue. The other question here is transparency. How much transparency is there to the public when a person serves on both the agency and on the Board of Supervisors? And it is an issue, and I think that the Board of Supervisors needs to be aware of that and be very cautious and very careful in what they do.
I agree. I definitely see a potential conflict of interest when, sort of on one hand, it's provision of services, essentially, and on the other, hopefully as a supervisor, you are looking at sort of the sustainability as a whole going forward, which may, you know, involve reducing provision of services, which then sort of negatively affects the bottom line of the other agency, right? And so I think it's tremendously important that, you know, hopefully sort of the one guides the other. And again, looking at transparency and really making sure that the decision-making processes are open to everyone and that everyone's aware. And I mean, perhaps, you know, the community needs to be more aware of that conflict as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've kind of run out of time. And we're going to return to the community and ask them to reflect on what you've heard and what you're taking home about finding a new way to be engaged with the future of the county, what you've heard about the way the candidates see the very same challenges that you identified and how they responded to the questions you asked. Our purpose was to have a conversation that would enhance our sense of engaging productively.
At this point, the conversations returned to the tables while the candidates and one lone reporter present slipped away into the night. I'm Bruce Robinson for KRCB Radio News.